Chapter 15. With two fingers in splints, Sean handled his knife awkwardly at lunch the next day, but his appetite was unimpaired. As was only right and fitting, he took no part in the conversation, except on the rare occasions that a remark was addressed directly to him. But he listened, his jaws chewing steadily and his eyes moving from speaker to speaker. He and Gary sat side by side in a backwater of the luncheon board, while the guests were grouped in order of seniority around weight. Stephen Erasmus, by age and wealth, was in the right-hand seat. Opposite him, Tim Hope Brown, just as wealthy but 10 years younger. Below him, Gunther Neuenhausen, Sam Tingle, and Simon Rousseau. If you added it all together, you could say that Wade Courtney had about 100,000 acres of land and 500,000 sterling sitting around his table. They were brown men, brown clothing, brown boots, and big, brown, calloused hands. Their faces were brown and battered-looking, and now that the meal was in its closing stages, their usual reserve was gone, and there was a tendency among them to talk all at the same time, and to perspire profusely. This was not entirely a consequence of the dozen bottles of good Cape Moselle that Waite had provided, nor of the piles of food they had eaten. It was more than that. There was a sense of expectancy among them, an eagerness they were finding it difficult to suppress. "Can I tell the servants to clear away, Waite?" Ada asked from the end of the table.
"Yes, thank you, my dear. We'll have coffee in here, please."
He stood up and fetched a box of cigars from the sideboard and carried it to each of his guests in turn. When the ends were cut and the tips were glowing, every man leaning back in his chair with a recharged glass and a cup of coffee in front of him, Ada slipped out of the room, and Waite cleared his throat for silence.
"Gentlemen," they were all watching him, "last Tuesday I spent 2 hours with the Governor. We discussed the recent developments across the Tugela."
Waite lifted his glass and sipped at it, then held it by the stem and rolled it between his fingers as he went on.
"2 weeks ago, the British agent at the Zulu King's Kraal was recalled. Recalled is perhaps the wrong word. The king offered to smear him with honey and tie him over an anthill, an offer that Her Britannic Majesty's agent declined with thanks. Shortly thereafter, he packed his bags and made for the border." There was a small ruffle of laughter. "Since then, Seti Wale has collected all his herds, which were grazing near the Tugela, and driven them into the north. He has commanded a buffalo hunt, for which he has decided he will need all his impis, 20,000 spears. This hunt is to be held along the banks of the Tugela, where the last buffalo was seen 10 years ago."
Waite sipped at his glass, watching their faces.
"And he has ordered that all wounded game is to be followed across the border."
There was a sigh then, a murmur from them. They all knew that this was the traditional Zulu declaration of war.
"So, man, what are we going to do about it? Must we sit here and wait for them to come and burn us out?"
Erasmus leaned forward, watching Waite.
"Sir Bartel Frere met Seti Wale's Indunas a week ago. He has given them an ultimatum. They have until January the 11th to disband the impis and take the Queen's agent back into Zululand. In the event that Seti Wale disregards the ultimatum, Lord Chelmsford is to command a punitive column of regulars and militia. The force is being assembled now and will leave Peter Marriottsburg within the next 10 days. He is to cross the Tugela at Rock's Drift and engage the impis before they break out. It's intended to end this constant threat to our border and break the Zulu nation forever as a military power.
It's about bloody time, said Erasmus.
His Excellency has gazetted me full colonel and ordered me to raise a commando from the Ladybird district. I've promised him at least 40 men, fully armed, mounted, and provisioned, who will be ready to join Chelmsford at the Tugela. Unless any of you object, I'm appointing you gentlemen as my captains, and I know I can rely upon you to help me make good my promise to His Excellency.
Suddenly Waite dropped his stilted manner and grinned at them.
You will collect your own pay. It'll be in cattle as usual.
How far north has Seti Weah driven his herds? Asked Tim Hope Brown.
Not far enough, I'll warrant, cackled Stephen Erasmus.
A toast,
said Stephen Rousseau, jumping to his feet and holding up his glass.
I give you a toast, the Queen, Lord Chelmsford, and the royal herds of Zululand.
They all stood and drank it, and then, suddenly embarrassed by their display, they sat down again, coughing awkwardly and shuffling their feet.
All right, said Waite. Let's get down to details.
Steph, you'll be coming, and your two eldest boys.
Yeah, three of us, and my brother and his son. Put down five. Erasmus.
Good. What about you, Gunther?
They began the planning. Men, horses, and wagons were marshalled on paper. Each of the captains was allotted a series of tasks. There was question, answer, and argument that filled the hours before the guests left the Thunis Corral. They rode in a bunch, tripling their horses, sitting slack and long-legged in the saddles, moving up the far slope along the road to Ladyburg. Waite and his son stood on the front step and watched them go.
Pa,
Gary tried tentatively for Waite's attention.
Yes, boy.
Waite kept his eyes on the group. Steph Erasmus turned in the saddle and waved his hat above his head. Waite waved back.
Why do we have to fight them, Pa? If the governor just sent somebody to talk to them, then we wouldn't have to fight.
Waite glanced at him, frowning slightly.
Anything worth having is worth fighting for, Gary. Seti Weah has raised 20,000 spears to take this from us.
Waite swept his arm in a circle that took in the whole of the Thunis Corral.
I think it's worth fighting for. Don't you, Sean?
You bet,
Sean nodded eagerly.
But couldn't we just make a treaty with them? Gary persisted.
Another cross on a piece of paper.
Waite spoke with fierce disdain. They found one like that on Pete Retrieff's body. Hell of a lot of good it did him. Waite walked back to the house with his sons following him. He lowered himself into his armchair, stretched his legs out in front of him and smiled at Ada.
Damn good lunch, my dear.
He clasped his hands over his stomach, belched involuntarily, and was immediately contrite.
I beg your pardon, it just slipped out.
Ada bent her head over her sewing to hide her smile.
We've got a lot to do in the next few days.
He turned his attention back to his sons.
We'll take one mule wagon and a pair of horses each. Now, about ammunition.
But, Pa, couldn't we just...
Gary started again.
Shut up,
said Waite, and Gary subsided miserably into one of the other chairs.
I've been thinking, announced Sean. Not you as well, growled Waite. Damn it to hell, here's your chance to win your own cattle, and that's just what I've been thinking,
Sean cut in.
Everybody will have more cattle than they know what to do with. The prices will drop way down.
They will at first, admitted Waite,
but in a year or two they'll climb back again.
Shouldn't we sell now?
Sell everything except the bulls and breeding cows. Then, after the war, we'll be able to buy back at half the price."
For a moment, Waite sat stunned. Then slowly his expression changed.
"My God! I never thought of that. And Pa..."
Sean was twisting his hands together in his enthusiasm. "We'll need more land. When we bring the herds back across the Tugela, there won't be enough grazing to go round. Mr. Pye has called the mortgages on Mount Sinai and Mahopa's Kloof. He's not using the land. Couldn't we lease them from him now before everybody starts looking for grazing?"
"We had a lot to do before you started thinking," said Waite softly. "But now we've really got to work."
He searched his pockets, found his pipe, and while he filled it with tobacco, he looked at Sean. He tried to keep his face neutral, but the pride kept showing.
"You keep thinking like that, and you'll be a rich man one day."
Waite could not know how true his prophecy would prove. The time was still remote when Sean could drop the purchase price of the Thunis Corral across a gaming table and laugh at the loss.